Join Greenbook at the 2024 Insight Innovation Exchange Conference Series. IIEX is your global hub for connections, inspiration, and innovative solutions in market research. Visit greenbook.org/events to learn more about events in Asia, the Americas, and Europe. Use the code PODCAST for 20% off general admission on all upcoming events.
Hello, everybody. It's Lenny Murphy with another edition of the Green Book Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to spend it with myself and my guest. And we love all of our guests equally, but occasionally we have folks that just have a special place in my heart. That is the case today. We have Steve Cohen, the founder and CEO of Information Insights, and also just a legend in the industry. Maybe we should call this our legend series for the podcast. Steve, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Lenny. It's great to be here with you. We have known each other since neither of us had gray hair. So it's been a while, I think.
it has been a while. Yeah, we met at ARF back in the heyday of ARF.
My brain doesn't go that far back. It's sort of like, first in, first out.
I understand. It's getting a little clogged up there. We got to make room. So
exactly.
With my usual hyperbole, but in this case, maybe not hyperbole, introduce you as a legend. Your bio and background is so extensive, I cannot do it justice. So now why don't you brag a little bit for our audience and give them a sense of why I consider you a legend. You'll get it, audience.
I'm sure. Right. It's like, enough of you talking about me. Let me talk about me, right?
right. Yes.
So I actually entered the market research industry in 1983 or so. And I, at the time, was working and doing film forecasting models for Polaroid Corporation. And soon thereafter, in about 1986, I transferred over to Information Insights. I had a group called the Custom Projects Group. And I started doing work in choice-based conjoint in late 1980s. Excuse me, I'm getting my dates wrong. It was 83 I moved over to do work in choice-based conjoint. There's a fellow named Jordan Louvier who is acknowledged as the founder of and first mover, if you will, in choice-based conjoint. He wrote a paper that appeared in Journal of Market Research in December 83. I called him on the phone, and for years he would say I was the only person who called him on the phone to discuss the paper. So I was really the first person to be doing choice-based conjoint commercially. Sawtooth kind of came around about 10 years after that with their choice-based conjoint product. In the meantime, I was involved in doing an academic paper on latent class choice-based conjoint, latent class being a market segmentation tool. So basically, you're finding groups of people who have similar kind of choice drivers, if you will. I then was involved in sort of what I consider the first paper to be looking at menu-based conjoint analysis, and about 2000 is when that paper was published in Journal of Market Research. And then in 2002, I presented a paper on using MaxDiff at the SMR conference in Barcelona. And then the next year, I won best paper at all SMR conferences in 2003. And it was, they published sort of like a compendium book of all the papers that had been published that year. I was the lead article, and I won 5,000 euros for becoming best paper that year. Hope I spent it wisely. I don't remember what I spent it on. And then I also, in 2003, presented MaxDiff at the Sawtooth Conference, won best paper at that. And then about 6 months later, Sawtooth had their software product for doing MaxDiff at that time. And then essentially in 2011, I won what's called the Parlin Award, and that's the award given by the American Marketing Association to sort of lifetime contributions in marketing research and marketing science. At the time, they were doing 1 year a practitioner, the following year an academic. I think they've gone to all academics now because I couldn't find enough practitioners to give it to. But it's really quite a prestigious award. It's the best award given away by the American Marketing Association. And then in 2013, there's an organization called the New York Market Research Council of New York City. It's a lot of big names in market research in the New York area. They elected me to the Marketing Research Hall of Fame. And then in 2016, there's another award given out by the Institute of Marketing Science, which is an academic group. They give out an award called the Buck Weaver Award. And I'll tell you who Buck Weaver is in just a second if you've never heard of him. And that's for lifetime contributions in marketing science. So it's been quite a ride. Let me just go back for a second and tell you and your listeners who Buck Weaver is, because I'm sure, you know, the number of people who've heard of Big Buck Weaver is probably really infinitesimal. So do you know who Buck Weaver is?
I do not.
Okay, well, this is going to be a good lesson here. So Buck Weaver, it turns out, is the only person I've been able to find, only market researcher I've been ever able to find, who was a cover of Time magazine. Buck worked for Alfred Sloan at General Motors, and he was essentially a guy who was sending out zillions of mail surveys every year. Yeah, the picture of him, he's sitting there very, you know, formally, tie, suit, the whole deal, behind his desk. He's got stacks of pieces of paper all over his desk. And the caption says, "A million opinions makes a fact."
All right.
So Buck is, so they give out the Buck Weaver Award every year. And he kind of was lost for a while in the sands of time. And there's a fellow named Vince Barabba. Vince used to be the head of the U.S. Census. He was also the head of market research in General Motors. And the way the story goes is that he was apparently, you know, in the archive room one day. And so he came upon Buck Weaver and said, "Who is Buck Weaver?" And one of the cool things you could do, which I wish I had with me, is that you can actually go on eBay and you can purchase some of Buck's old surveys that he sent out, you know, little pamphlets about so big. And you kind of look at what he did and you say, "God, things haven't changed that much, have they?" You know, you look at the little pictures and questions, you know, at the time in the 30s, they were really interested in something called streamlining. So everything, you know, was kind of, I don't remember these old pictures of trains going really fast with the lines, you know, behind it, the cars going really fast, you know. So they were talking about streamlining everything. It was very big in the 1930s, so he had a lot of questions about streamlining. Anyway, so that's what Buck Weaver is. Anyway, so my sort of passion, if you will, has been looking at choice models, and that's partially what we're here to talk about today. So I'll stop there for a second if you want to stop me from blabbering on.
Well, no, the point here is for you to blabber.
And,
yes, I mean, it's just interesting blabber. So I always think of you as the father of MaxDiff.
Thank you.
And yeah, you're welcome, Dad. And what an advancement it was in choice-based models overall. You know, much simpler, much cleaner. Yeah, yep. some greater utility. Now let's get really nerdy. And for the audience who may not be as familiar with conjoint and choice-based models, why don't you give an explanation on the approach and some of the use cases? And I think that's where also you've really pushed the limits within Information Insights in embedding choice-based models, you know, Bayes, all that great stuff from an analytical standpoint. They've done some amazing stuff. So let's talk about that for inspiration for our audience and how these tools can be used, because they can do some amazing stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, certainly the number of applications is, from what I've read in the industry press and, you know, the academic articles and so on, they say there's roughly over 20 to 30,000 applications worldwide every year these days of using choice-based conjoint. And the idea behind it is what you're looking to do is finding out what the drivers of people's choices are. And, you know, it's very important, certainly in the academic discipline of decision science, and also microeconomics is another place that it comes from. And the idea in microeconomics is that people try to maximize the utility of what they buy. So what we want to understand is, by presenting you with a series of choices from a set of products or a set of services or whatever it is, a set of items, really, what are the characteristics of those items and products or services that are saying, "Yeah, I'll buy that one and I won't buy the other one"? So it's a technique that's called compositional. In other words, you're going to break down the product or service or whatever it is into a series of product features or attributes that they may have. And what you want to do is, you know, once you break down into pieces, you're looking to say, well, what's the impact of each of those pieces on the eventual decision to buy? Now, obviously, it's a technique that is not true to the official, yes, I'm actually going to buy the thing. So it's what people say is important to them. So that's probably the biggest downfall of choice models, is that you don't actually observe the true choice. You're giving people a hypothetical choice. But there has been some work showing that the hypothetical choices are pretty good in terms of predicting what people will do when they go out and choose. Now, it really falls more in the system two thinking rather than system one thinking. So system two thinking is more sort of a considered decision. System one is sort of like, you know, here it is, quick, buy it kind of thing. You know, don't think about it a whole lot. Which one would you do? But there has been some work with these choice models to try and get at, you know, see if you could do it in system one thinking. So, for example, you might have a timer on the choice that people make, you know, or you actually measure the amount of time they're thinking. And people who make the choice quick, you put into system one, and people who are making it more the considered choice, put them to system two, which of course conflicts with the whole idea of, if you have somebody who's making quick choices, are they just trying to speed through a survey that they might be looking at? So you have to kind of separate one from the other along the way. But these choice models have been used, you know, since really 1983, 1984 have they been used. And that's about when I started getting introduced to it, was about that time. You mentioned Max Diff also, because that, it turns out, I mean, I didn't make this whole cloth out of my own head. I mentioned Jordan Louvier, the professor, and he had done some work. He had published a paper in, the early 90s, maybe the early 80s or so. The paper was looking at decisions around energy and water conservation in a city in Canada, and they were presenting people with different options, which is really what Max Diff does. You've got a bunch of different, I'll call them objects or statements, or whatever you want to call it, and you're trying to figure out what's more important to people. But till I started working with it, I started working with that whole notion in the mid-90s or so, because I had been working for one of the computer companies, and we were looking at what was driving the choice of desktop computers for IT buyers, for, you know, the IT department, or, you know, together with the finance department, buying computers for use by their different sort of levels of people, you know, from an admin up through a workstation that might go to somebody else. And they had asked me, you know, let's try and figure out what's driving these choices, but we don't want them to necessarily say, well, should I have a faster or a slower computer, but how important is speed in the decision? How important is ease of use in the decision? So there were more abstract kinds of ideas, as opposed to, let's say, you know, do you want the 1 megahertz fast computer versus the 1.5 megahertz? And that's really what you do in Contour. And you try and get very specific about what the features and what the attributes of those features are, as opposed to MaxDiff is more sort of more abstract kind of thing. And so I started doing it in the mid-90s, had a lot of good success with it. And I really didn't publish about it, at least what was going on, until the work I had done in 2002 at the SMR conference, and then the following year at the SMR conference again. That particular work was, I was working with a company in Panama, and they were looking at what the abstract features of why people drank coffee. One of their biggest clients, I believe, was Nestle. And so we sort of had an attribute rating test. So we had 13 attributes. So we said, you know, how important is, you know, gets me wake up in my day, you know, helps me with my digestion, helps me to be friendly with people around me, jumpstarts, you know, what I want to do, those kinds of things. And those were all 1 to 5 ratings, which, you know, before Max Diff, a lot of people were doing those kinds of things and finding that everything was important. So I like to say, if it wasn't important, you wouldn't put it on the list in the first place, you know. And then you get, you know, in lots of countries, there are tendencies to use the high end of the scale or the low end of the scale or the middle. So you've got, you know, scale use bias in one kind or another you got to take into account. And so when we analyzed the ratings data, we found that it was actually 6 countries in Central America we were looking at. It was about 150, 200 interviews in each of the 6-7 countries. We found that some countries had a tendency to be yay sayers. And so when we did the typical factor analysis, cluster analysis kind of thing, which, by the way, I hate. When you do that sort of thing, you get segments that are all yay-sayers, you know, hoo-hoo-hoo-ha, you know, big deal, doesn't tell you anything about what drove it. Whereas a similar group of people, 700-800 people, did the max diff task, and everything came out just beautiful. And that's why we won the paper, essentially, that year. But max diff is really a variant of choice-based chondroit, but it's gotten pretty mature at this point. You know, what kind of drives me crazy, Lenny, to be honest with you, is all the companies who say they do max diff, and the royalty checks haven't shown up yet. I'm still waiting for them, and you know, so be it. That happens. That was tongue-in-cheek statement, of course. You know, I mean, for the betterment of mankind, we put it out there. So there's lots of, you know, work that's been done with choice-based chondroit. I still love what it is and what it does. But to tell you the truth, I mean, this is part of what's rankling me these days, is that if you look at the last 20 years or so of choice-based chondroit, you'll find there hasn't been a whole lot new that's being done. Mm-hmm. Certainly, like I said, the work I did in MaxDiff was 2003, so that's 21 years ago at this point. Like I said, Sawtooth came out with their MaxDiff software late 2003, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe early 2004. So it's been 20 years. They've done a lot of good things with MaxDiff and make it easier to use. So they got Bandit MaxDiff and this MaxDiff, and using the mosts versus the leasts, or the bests versus the worst. But you know, you look at what's been done at least, and I'm particularly talking about market research. There hasn't been a whole lot done. If you look at, you know, the pure play chondroit kinds of companies, and I don't mean to disparage, you know, there are those, I'm not going to name them. There's the, you know, the online research kinds of companies, data collection companies, even the big consulting companies like, you know, McKinsey or BCG. They're all essentially using the same technology that I was involved in developing, you know, introducing to market research world in the 80s and the 90s, you know. So one of the things that's really sort of motivated me to look at new things is the fact that everybody's doing the same old, same old. It's the same thing over and over again. And nobody's really said, well, can I look under the hood and sort of say, can I do things a little better?
Well, I hear you. And we could argue that from a, you know, research as an industry, other than changes of maybe form factor, you know, from mail to phone to online, the kind of the interface, that the ways we go about doing things from a design and analytical perspective haven't changed much. They've maybe gotten far more efficient, more automated, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, gosh, I remember the first time that I did a conjoint study in 2005. And what a pain in the ass, right? I
mean, yeah.
You know, the utilities, sure, and the simulator, and it was really expensive and complex and, you know, very challenging to do, where now we embed MaxDiff into Grit without a second thought, because it's just so easy technologically. And maybe for the audience, and you keep me honest here, when I think about the difference between, let's call it traditional conjoint and MaxDiff, my go-to is, if I need to understand the optimal configuration for a product based on features, then that's when, is a solution to embed within my study, that's what conjoint is for. If I need to understand the trade-offs on more conceptual things, that's where MaxDiff is.
Absolutely.
So, yep. Got it. Yep. Good. Okay. So I'm not an idiot. That's good.
Yeah.
Now, to your point, you said you're experimenting. You've been trying to do new things. And I know from over the years of our conversations that you have been doing that. So tell us, what's the new stuff? What's the advancement?
Sure. Well, before I go there, let me also mention that you kind of got MaxDiff and choice-based conjoint. You know, I think you pegged them pretty well, and I want to agree with you on what you said. One of the things that I don't see being done a lot is the two of them getting the same study. So in other words, you can have the conceptual part, and you can have the more detailed part in the same study. And now you say, well, how can I combine those in some way to know how maybe the conceptual part sort of maps to the more detailed part? And there are ways to do that through latent class models, to be able to do what I wrote a paper that appeared in the Journal of Market Research, I think it was 96 or 98, we called it joint segmentation. So you're basically saying, I can segment people in the max diff, so people who have different sort of theoretical or conceptual drivers, and I can also have a segmentation based on the choices that people made, and maybe there are different drivers, and the two of them hopefully should be related to one another in some way. And so what this joint segmentation does, it estimates the choice segments from this choice-based conjoint, it estimates the max diff conceptual segments, and it estimates at the same time the cross-type between them. And I haven't seen many people doing that, if at all, but I, you know, maybe happening because I don't see everything. Anyway, let's talk about the new things that have been sort of occupying my time. And there's really, I made some notes here, if I may, just to remind myself what to say. But the first one that I believe is probably, you know, could be the next big thing, all right, in choice-based conjoint. So here, I'm gonna start that particular discussion off by saying to you, all right, and this is not a trick, all right, if you don't know the answer, it's all right. So what's the one thing that people don't have enough of?
Time.
Excellent. Good. That's the correct answer.
Oh, all right. Okay. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Putting yes, you may. I'm going to give you another one. Okay, so putting time aside, what's the second thing people don't have enough of?
Money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Time and money. And why is that? Well, if you look at sort of microeconomics, I'm sure you may have heard the expression, choices are made under constraints. You know, people don't have enough time, they can't do everything they want to do, and people typically don't have enough money. I mean, unless you're, you know, Jeff Bezos or somebody like that, you'll have enough money to do what you want to do. So now let me ask you another question. It has nothing to do with time and money, but if you're going to do a choice-based conjoint, and I know you've seen quite a few in your day, and I ask your listeners to think about it, has anybody ever included the buyer's budget in a choice-based conjoint? So I'm not saying, you know, asking them outside the survey, saying, you know, how much money you have to spend or how much do you typically spend or anything like that. Have it inside the modeling exercise.
No, that's because that's usually with the pricing, you know, von Westendorf, yes, something of that nature. It's a whole other section.
Correct.
Not embedded in. Yeah.
Okay. And if I may also say that people are making a choice in the choice-based conjoint, they're making choices, but we haven't put a constraint on them. Nor do we know what their own constraints are. So I'm not saying I'm going to put a constraint on them, but I'm going to say to them, can I figure out what your particular constraint is, your particular budget? And I can do that by analyzing the choices people made. Now, let me also say that there are other kinds of constraints that are out there in the world. For example, some people can't eat gluten. Some people can't eat, you know, don't buy products that have extra sugar in them. They have to have, you know, artificial sweeteners. Some people don't products with too much salt. A physician may not prescribe something because there's too many side effects. So there's all sorts of constraints that we have.
Or self-imposed values, right? All of those things. I'm not going to support that company, or I've made these ethical choices, right? Yeah, that's a complex configuration. Yeah,
absolutely. So what we want to do is, within the context of the choice-based conjoint, we want to figure out what the person's constraints are. Now, I must say, trying to figure out a value-based constraint is a bit more difficult, but it turns out there's a whole set of literature out there called taboo kinds of choices that people make. So and the taboo choice literature says some things like, some researchers went to, you know, the Middle East, and they said, would you be willing to give up the claims you have to your ancestral lands if I give you a big amount of money? And people said no. All right. So that's really a taboo constraints has to deal with things like trading off values of health, peace, those kinds of things against money. So it's the, if you will, it's the taboo trade-off is I'm trying to remember what it is, and I can't remember, but it's sort of like, the sublime versus the
material.
Yeah, the sublime versus material, if you will. So material is the money, sublime is the peace, health kinds of things, the value. Yeah. So that kind of stuff typically can't be done in a choice-based contract, but you can put those other things in, you know, what's the sugar content? What's the gluten content? What's the cost along the way? And so these new budget models, I'm doing budget in its broadest sense of a constraint, if you will. When you actually do a side-by-side of analysis, which I've done on probably a dozen data sets so far, the underlying math, if you understand the underlying math, it turns out the budget models will give you a better result or an equal result as the standard choice-based contract. So it's always going to be at least as good as or even better. By even better, I mean if you think looking at things like a measure of fit to the model, an R-square kind of thing, you know, which might be a measure of how well the model is doing. If you're doing holdout tasks, you know, so you have a training set of choices and a holdout set of choices, it'll predict better to the holdouts and so on. And I think it's just remarkable that it's able to do that. And it's really the only technology that I know of that allows you to put in budgets into the modeling kind of thing. I think it's really... I've been amazed at how good the results are and how interpretable they are. One of the interesting things that happens with it is price sensitivity, individuals' price sensitivity. And we're typically using these Bayesian models. And for the people who don't know what Bayesian models do, one of the things it does is to get you coefficients or elasticities or sensitivities or weights associated with each of the attributes that you're testing at the individual level. So you would have your own set of weights for each of the attributes. So I have my own set of weights. They're idiosyncratic to each of us and to each of the people. And so it turns out one of the things that happens is that the budget model finds, because it's estimating not only the budget, but also the price sensitivity of budget model is lower, meaning more positive, if you will. So people are less price sensitive under the budget model. You go, wait a second, what's going on there? Well, what's happening really is the following. And I'll use a very simple example. Let's say you want to go to the supermarket. You want to buy a six-pack of beer, all right? You know, you've got all sorts of choices when you go to the beer case. You know, you've got the Belgian beers, you got the American beers, you got the Italian beers, the British beers. You got all these beers to choose from. And let's say you say to yourself, well, I'm not going to spend more than $15 on it. That's my budget. And so what the budget model says is any beers that are over $15, you're not going to buy because it's past your budget. Now, there are instances where maybe, you know, there are situations where you will exceed your budget, but you're not going to exceed your budget to 2, 3, 4x of what it was. You know, you'll let it creep up a little bit along the way. And so what happens is that anything that is above your budget, you will never buy. It's you're essentially the utility of value you place on it because it's too expensive is zero. And so what happens is that, let's say you have a choice of a beer that's $12 or $13 under a $15 budget. Who cares? $12, $13, who cares? So price sensitivity is flatter, if you will. Now, one of the things I found that happens is that there's all this variability in choices. You got to take it into account. And what I found happens, since price gets less expensive, other things like brands and features turn to get less important. So now that price becomes less important in the choice, other things sort of suck up all the variation and choices that happen, and they get more interesting and more important. So brands started getting more important, and to which I say, well, isn't that nice to be able to tell brand manager people are less price sensitive than we were thinking they might be? And brands are really more important along the way. So that, if you will, is the budget model. The budget model I'm really excited about.
I'm just thinking of use cases, right?
There's tons of them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I always go back to the famous statement from the CMO of P&G that their goal is to have a one-to-one relationship with everybody on the planet in real time. And, you know, they do that by delivering the right message to the right person at the right time. And when we're
at the right price.
Right price, the right configuration of products. And we have that personalization, right? The technologies enable that scalability now to have very personalized configurations of products. And that's what you are describing is the central piece of driving that piece of things. And I'll give you one example. It was actually really, really interesting this week for me. We put a car in a shop thinking that it just needed some work. get the phone call. No, you need a whole new transmission. And so the decision at that point goes for me of, well, nope, I guess we're buying a new car. So, and it was such a great experience to be able to, now this wasn't targeted towards me, but the exercise was going online before I hate going on car lots, right? Like, no, I'm going to pick out what the hell I want before I even get on there. And, you know, combining all the different components while juggling towards price. Here's my, you know, this is the range that I need to be in, but here's the features and capabilities, et cetera, and going through all of that, which was a real world exercise that you're describing. And I don't think we realize how we do that every day so often.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've done this budget model with things as inexpensive as a dozen eggs. I found about 10% of the people were budget constrained, meaning that they had a budget limit that was less than the maximum price we tested. So we tested a dozen eggs that were from $2 to $6. And about 10% of them said they wouldn't go as high as $6. They wouldn't. So one of the things that's cool as happens is now that I have sort of a budget limit for each person, I can start segmenting people in sort of low, medium, high budgets, or, you know, however many groups along the way. And I can start profiling who are they, what turns them on, you know, what are their demographics, values, you know, with other shopping behaviors and so on. So it's really a cool little technique. I really like it a lot. So the next one is what's called attribute non-attendance in the literature, ANA. And the idea is that the basic choice model that we use for choice-based conduct assumes that people are paying attention to all the things that you show them, and they are trading off those. It's a compensatory model, meaning I'm willing to pay more money to get better features. I'm trading off, you know, spending money versus getting something I like. And the attribute non-attendance model says, well, wait a second. If we have situations where, you know, people may be confused or new to the category, or there's a lot of features that we're showing to people, a lot of features and levels, lots of products we're showing to people. People do what's called, they make a choice under heuristic. A heuristic is, I'm going to simplify the decision for myself in some way. I'm going to pay attention to the things that I care about, and I won't pay attention to the things I don't care about. All right.
So look at reviews, for instance.
Yeah, whatever it is they're going to do, but they help, they simplify the decision for themselves. And so if you were to do a choice-based conjoint study and you find out a particular attribute has a value of zero, all right, or close to zero. So now the question you have to ask yourself, does that mean they don't care about it or they didn't pay attention to it? And that's why it's zero. So what these attribute non-attention models do, you know, in terms of the background of what it's doing, it tries to understand for each person, did they pay attention or not? And if I can get really nerdy and tell you the detailed math, but the basic idea is for each of the attributes, it's going to sort of turn it on and turn it off. Okay. And what it's going to say is, do I better fit this person's behavior when I turn it on or turn it off?
Did that come into effect did you start playing with that in 2020 when scarcity became a driver versus features?
I did not. No, it wasn't me. But a lot of it has to do, you know, again, with situations where there's a lot of the stuff that's in the academic literature looks at when, you know, things are there's just a lot of things people have to pay attention to. And certainly we know heuristics are out there all the time. And behavioral economics certainly tells us that people use heuristics all the time to simplify their decision making, which allows me to segue into another thing that I'm working on, which is, so this one's been around for a while. I know Sawtooth has published a paper on this idea, but so I mentioned earlier that everybody likes to maximize utility along the way. And again, if you look at what's happening within the context of the choice-based conjoint, people are essentially saying, I'm going to look at the features, prices, brands, whatever, of each product individually. I'm going to mentally calculate which one is the best, the one with the highest utility, and that's the one I'm going to choose. What behavioral economics tells us is that actually what people do is important in the context. They kind of take into account not only the things they might choose, but what other things are out there, right? And you may have heard the expression, losses loom larger than gains. And so what some people do is they want to avert losses, loss aversion, or they want to, the official kind of thing is called regret minimization, that I minimize the regret of not choosing the other thing, if you will. And so some people are utility maximizers. Some people are regret minimizers or loss avoiders. And there are probably a whole lot of other kinds of heuristics people are doing that we're not clever enough to figure out. So it turns out if you're looking at a choice-based contract and everybody's using utility maximization, and you can get a set of results. And it turns out if you use the regret minimization tools and techniques, you get a set of results. And if you compare the two in terms of fit, the literature basically says that they're not that far off one another. The fit is about the same. But since in the regret minimization loss aversion world, you're taking into account what other things are out there, you're acting more like a behavioral economist. And it turns out the predictions that you get from that approach are different than you get from the predictions in the utility maximization approach, because what you chose by trying to avoid a loss depends upon what else is available to you to choose from. Okay. So in that case, what you're able to do is to segment people into these different groups. And it turns out that figuring out who's which gives you even better results than either one, you know, saying being monolithic about using utility maximization or monolithic about regret minimization. A hybrid approach is actually the best thing that you get out of it.
Is there almost a matrix that could be, and again, I'm thinking personally, we'll use 2020 example. I was never a hoarder or prepper before 2020, but you know what? By God, we started stocking up. We always have toilet paper, right? We have lots and lots of toilet paper. And just thinking through, I could almost envision a matrix, a decision-making matrix, right? Of this integration between kind of system one, system two, and the more utilitarian components of decision-making, and that you're describing this holy grail of understanding these factors that drive decision-making by segment, you know, in profile, almost like the big five personality profiles, but now it's driven by these other utilities that you're describing. That's pretty cool stuff, Steve.
It is very cool stuff. I'm trying to think. The last thing I'm working on is, and we can wrap up the conversation as soon as I pontificate about this last one, if you don't mind. And so one of the things that's bothered me is, you know, Sawtooth has this thing they call adaptive contract analysis, adaptive choice-based contract. And essentially what they do is they give a bunch of pre-questions, you know, would you rather have feature one, two, or three, or what's important to you, two or three. And then they adapt that and then show you choices to make. And it's pretty good stuff. I personally have never used it, to tell you the truth, because I'm more interested in, there's been a whole set of papers written about what are called, I'll use the phrase IASB, individually adaptive sequential Bayesian choice. IASB, individual adaptive sequential Bayesian choice. And so the idea behind that is, let me kind of give you a choice task to do, typical choice task you might get in choice-based conjoint. I'll keep track of that, maybe do two or three of those. And then sort of in between beginning of the fourth, after the third task, I'm going to kind of run a little model and figure out what's important to you. All right. And what I'm going to do is then decide, okay, what's the best thing to give you as the fourth thing to look at, based on what you told me you liked in the first one, two, three.
Is that what, remember Afanova?
Yes.
That sounds very similar to their approach.
It is similar, but I think this is a bit more rigorous than what they were doing, because it's really hard in the sense of you got to run this, if you will, run a model in between, and then you got to decide we're going to show somebody. Well, that's got to be done if you're doing an online interview. It's got to be done lightning fast. And a lot of Afanova, I mean, I don't know the full details of what they were doing, but the big barrier has been doing it fast when you get down to it. So it turns out there's some work that was done in the machine learning world that I've glommed onto where they're figuring out how to do that for in another domain, if you will, but we're trying to develop some software to do just that with people where we get what should the fourth one be, and then if you have the first four, what should the fifth one be, and so on and so on. That's still a work in progress on our end, but you know, we're hoping to finish in the next 2-3 months or so test it out. So unfortunately, I don't know who I'm going to talk to about it. But
well, let's have a conversation offline.
Super. Yeah. So that's kind of what I've been working at, and it's I'm trying to introduce some new innovations, you know, to the people listening to this or watching it, that are things that I think can hopefully, you know, say, yeah, in the last 20 years we haven't done anything, but you know, Steve's at it again with some new stuff.
It's cool stuff. We are almost out of time, but we wanted to get to, you know, the dreaded two-letter word in this, although we can probably save that for another conversation.
Oh, sure.
But I would guess on what we're talking about, especially from the speed component, that because of the implementation of generative AI and the efficiencies, particularly at the chip level, right, to power that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That is going to open up even more capabilities.
Sure.
Which I would argue would make the solutions that you're building more critical, more accessible, because we're just expanding computing power and data synthesis and the ability to get to the analytics in a much more efficient way. Is that kind of where your head is?
Well, actually, all these things I've described to you, we're writing in Python, which allows you to go from what CPU computing, which is what we're typically using, to GPU computing. The GPU is the graphics processing unit, and the big maker of graphics cards is NVIDIA, and I unfortunately did not buy NVIDIA stock several years ago.
I was kicking myself a few weeks ago, too, with that.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, it turns out we've been looking at these. The problem with trying to do chondroid studies with GPU is that the communication between the CPU and the GPU takes time. You know, even how fast everything is, still takes time. And the chondroid data sets are not really big enough to try to take advantage of the GPU. So in the context of artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, all those kinds of things, there's enormous databases is what they're looking at. And so the GPU can.
Well, so we just need to do more conjoint, right?
Right. A couple of million respondents, and you'll have enough data to do it. But a typical study, I mean, we tried it with like 2,000-3,000 respondents, and it doesn't go much faster than the typical CPU on the GPU. So it's like, the problem again is the communication, because if it just doesn't work fast, let's put it that way, yet. So yeah. We'll see what happens.
Well, Steve, you've been incredibly gracious with your time. Our listeners have been gracious as well. It is always a pleasure to catch up with you. And again, you now, listeners, I hope you realize why I said Steve is a legend. The man is. So honored to have the chance to talk to you.
Please. Thank you so much.
Yeah, seriously.
It's always good to talk to you. Always good to talk to you, Lenny.
You always bring a smile to my face when I see you at a conference. It's been too long, and it's great to have this chance to catch up and know that you're still building this body of work that has huge long-term implications for the entire industry. And listeners, that's the takeaway, right?
Thank you.
Think about all these things that are doing that we do. These are standard tools in the tool belt, and they will continue to be. The form factor may change, right? But the underlying thesis and the approach will absolutely, they're here to stay. And this is the man who helped bring them to life. So thank you.
Wow. Thank you so much, Lenny, for the compliments, and always great to see you. And I'm glad you're doing well. And let's try and figure out when we're going to do this again. Okay.
Absolutely. All right. Last thing, where can people find you, Steve?
Well, I'm at Information Insights. Information is spelled with a number 4 instead of an F-O-R. So it's I-N, the number 4, Mation Insights. And you can do Steve at IN4INS.com. Information Insights, IN4INS.com. That's the easiest way to get to me, Steve at.
Okay, there we go. All right. Thank you so much, Steve. Really appreciate it. Want to give a big shout out to our producer, Natalie. She is the one who keeps all the wheels turning, to our editors, to our sponsors, and most of all, to our listeners. So that's it for this edition of the Green Book Podcast. Everybody take care, and we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Join Green Book for the 2024 Insight Innovation Exchange. This global conference series, also known as IIEX, is where connections are made, inspiration is found, and innovative solutions are discovered. With more than 90% of attendees using IIEX insights to shape strategic business decisions, the return on investment is undeniable. Whether you're in Asia Pacific, North America, Europe, or Latin America, IIEX is your gateway to the latest market research best practices, tech innovation, and strategies for transforming insights into action. Nurture your career and business with insights from across the globe. And here's a bonus. Use the special code PODCAST to save 20% on general admission for all IIEX events. Visit greenbook.org/events today to learn more and register. See you there.